Welcome to Basic Brewing Radio for Thursday, August 19th, 2010. I'm James Spencer. Here at Basic Brewing Radio, we're all about home brewing. This week, our final audio episode from our trip to the National Homebrewers Conference in Minneapolis, Minnesota. We feature a conversation between two beer lovers who happen to be foodies as well. Steve Wilkes sits down with homebrew chef Sean Paxton to talk food philosophy, beer, and what it's like to feed around 1,000 of your closest friends. If you're new to homebrewing and would like to get into the hobby for the first time, check out our website, basicbrewing.com, where you can find archives of our audio and video podcasts and our DVDs to walk you through basic and more advanced brewing techniques. And you can follow me on Twitter. My username is Basic Brewing, all one word. You can find me on Facebook at facebook.com/basicbrewing.james. And our Basic Brewing Radio and Basic Brewing Video show page on Facebook is facebook.com/basicbrewing. Thanks again to everybody clicking on the Amazon.com associate link on our basicbrewing.com site. Whenever you think of Amazon, think of us. Click on our associate link first. It won't cost you any extra. You'll be helping us to bring you the show, and we appreciate your support. So anytime you hear us traveling, you can thank your support in one way or the other, and we're going to be doing some traveling. This week, I'll talk about that in a minute, and Andy and I, looks like, are going to the Great American Beer Festival this year. So thank you very, very much for your support. By the way, we also have associate links for Brew Your Own Magazine and the American Homebrewers Association on our site, too, so you can help them out and help us out, too. You can this list gets longer all the time. You can find our Basic Brewing iPhone app on the iTunes Store, and we are on the BlackBerry podcast directory now, too. I think I'm almost all the way caught up with email. I may have missed a couple along the way, but the email albatross is now no longer hanging around my neck, and I appreciate the patience of everybody who's waited so long for responses on that. A while back, I talked about tools to make your own homebrew labels for your homebrew bottles, and I've received some suggestions for online sites to help make your bottles a bit more spiffy and professional-looking. Alan from Christchurch, New Zealand, sent a link to an online label maker, or as Tom Brokaw would say, an online label maker, on the Cooper's site. Alan is a member of the ABC Canterbury University Brew Club, by the way. Alan says the Cooper site is a good starting point and lets you apply your own artwork or photos as well as brew details. And Alan sent a provocative label that he made for a beer he calls Whole Garden. by the way, in talking about these sites, I'll be posting links to all these websites in the description of this episode on basicbrewingradio.com, so you can find them there. Chris from Clinton Township, Michigan, and David from the UK both sent links to beerlabelizer.com. That's beerlabelizer.com. Chris says it's a site that has 6 different templates, and all you have to do is fill in some info about your beer, like beer name, beer style, and catchy taglines, who brewed it, the ABV, and the bottle size. And you can print from that template. Also, Paul Charlesworth, who has appeared on this program in the past, sent a link to sheetlabels.com. Paul says, I bought some round labels that fit on the top of my caps from sheetlabels.com, who have great, in his humble opinion, prices. And Paul says he's used their online templates to create labels with Adobe Illustrator. Paul says, in the past I've used PrintShop, but I imagine that you can use any program that can read EPS, PDF, PSD, doc files, and make text that you can apply, follow a path. So if you want to go around the label in a curve. So that's a great idea if you don't want labels for the bottle itself, but for the caps on top. And the particular template that Paul uses for those is SL115. And again, that's from the sheetlabels.com site. Well, thanks, guys. It's always awesome to get great advice from our listeners out there. Listeners. Then there's this from Jennifer in Lansing, Michigan. Jennifer says, I'm working on a 3-day continuous research experiment for my thesis. Actually, it's taken months of work and planning to get here. Jennifer says, well, I was doing one part of 5 wetting and drying cycles and taking the CO2 flux from my microcosms when I realized that I'd forgotten to note what time I took the time. If you forget to, she says, zero measurement. How am I supposed to know how much CO2 was produced in an hour when I don't know when I started the hour? It's important to do it right after I wet the soil aggregates in the microcosm. We all know how that is, don't we, with the... then I remembered that I had started a show on my Basic Brewing iTouch app right when I took the first measurement. All I had to do was look at how far into the show I was. She says, thanks, James. No problem. And Jennifer says, thanks for keeping me company through this experiment, especially at 3 a.m. I've probably listened to 30 hours of shows so far. Wow. That can't be healthy, right? That's... A little goes a long way, probably. But glad we could help, Jennifer. And good luck with the wetting and drying cycles there with your microcosms. I wish I could understand what she was doing. One more, just to prove that I have been reading. And it's always cool to get email from people who are smarter than me, which happens all the time. One more, just to prove that I have been reading the email. Richard from Raleigh, North Carolina writes, there was a comment made during the show about the difficulty of getting accurate measurements of weights as small as 2 grams. My kitchen scale would be absolutely useless trying to measure that weight. However, for one of my older hobbies, I do have a scale that could easily make that measurement. Richard says, I reload my own ammunition, a hobby where accurate measurements are important. The typical scale used to measure powder is accurate to 0.1 grams. There are 7,000 grains per pound, so there are 15.4 grains per gram, making measurements of a couple of grams an easy and accurate measurement with a powder scale. So if a homebrewer needs to make a measurement of a couple of grams, find a buddy who reloads. He will have the scale you need. Very cool. Thanks, Richard. I love it when tools designed for other uses find their way into the brewery. And one last reminder, I'll be in Salt Lake City this weekend for the 2nd annual Beehive Brewhoff. I'm hoping to record some fun stuff there at the Beehive Brewhoff, both audio and video stuff while I'm there. But this is the first out-of-state trip where I'm going solo, so it should be interesting to see how I fare. However, our buddy Douglas Warzynski says he'll be helping out with the competition, so maybe I can enlist him as a grip, as they say. I bet he'll work for beer, because I know I will. Okay, let's get on to our chat with Steve Wilkes and Sean Paxton. You can find Sean's website at homebrewchef.com, and starting August 26th, you'll be able to hear his new show on the Brewing Network.
Well, Sean Paxton, we just took a little video tour of the kitchen back there, and you showed us about brining. It's very interesting.
Why, thank you.
Yeah, and now I'm curious, what does it take to put on a banquet of this size? We've got 1,300 homebrewers here. You're going to feed us all.
Well, not everybody. There's actually only room for 940 people.
Some will be left out. That's their tough one.
Well, not everybody signed up for dinner. So,
still, how many folks are we feeding?
940.
Jeez.
So out of that 940, we have about 30 vegetarians, and we have 2 different people who are allergic to ones. At least has let me know that they're allergic to nuts, and another person is allergic to eggplant and zucchini.
Oh, wow.
Okay. So just in case.
Right.
So it makes it a little bit more interesting.
I guess so. So then tell me, let's just go with the chicken. So this is the entree to start. How do you go about preparing that much chicken so that everybody gets a really nice entree?
Well, this is where you start to do a lot of culinary math. You start to think about what you want the plate to look like to begin with. So you're actually conceptualizing the end result before you're actually even talking about flavor, because you're just looking at the components that make that dish. You start to look at, okay, this is a 3-course meal. you know, I'll give them 6 ounces of wild rice. So you we actually have scoops in the kitchen that do 6 ounces thereabout, and depending on the weight, and we put that onto the plate. And that's the mound that everything's built on, or the foundation, if you will, of the plate. You do that with mashed potatoes, you do that with noodles, you do it with spetzla, whatever you're doing.
Right.
So once you've conceptualized that piece and what it's going to be as a starch, and then you have your vegetable, and then you have your protein, and usually your protein has a sauce. And so you start to break this all down, and all of a sudden you start to see you have lots of recipes. And then you also need to start thinking about volume-wise, how much you're actually going to be, you know, buying, sourcing out, where it's going to come from, how is it coming, because, you know, if we got, you know, so we're actually giving 2 4-ounce breasts, so 8 ounces of meat per plate for the meat eaters. And that will be 2 chicken breasts that, do we get those, you know, because that's a lot of labor to prep all that, or do we get it already pre-prepped? Then when it comes in, to actually prepare it, make sure it's all clean, ready to go, and sort through everything and double check the count, because, you know, supposedly they're all 4 ounces, but, you know, you can't exactly get every single chicken 4 ounces, at least not yet. I mean, that perfect. But so in thinking about that, and then thinking about, okay, so now we have all this chicken, how are we going to cook it all? How are we going to prepare it? And in that, it's kind of fun, because to stop and actually look at a brining, you know, use is such a great versatile way to make sure that there's flavor, it's moist, it's juicy, and it's more forgiving. So we can actually, today we're actually taking it all, drying it, searing it, and then at that point it's still rare, if not raw, on the inside. And we'll put that on sheet trays ready to go with some olive oil on them, and they're ready to go into the oven. And we put these on speed racks into the walk-in to cool completely so that we don't have to worry about food safety. And then tomorrow, right before we actually need it, they'll go right into a hot 350-degree oven for about 15 minutes or so, and they'll be perfectly cooked, and then they'll go right onto the plate.
Wow.
Then we'll also be doing this in a tandem. So it'll be timed, and there'll be somebody just at the ovens putting things in, taking things out, and restocking the line, because when you start to think about 930 plates or 40 plates coming off the line at once, you basically need to stop and think about, okay, how many plates per minute, and work it backwards to actually when you want to serve it, and then give yourself a buffer on top of that. Because just to make the salad, we'll start actually plating the salad at 7 a.m. It'll be done about 11. So it's going to take 2 people 4 hours to make 940 plates of salad. And then with that, we have 15 gallons of dressing that will be put into the table. And so thinking about, like, how much salad dressing are you going to put on your salad? Well, you might like it heavy, you might like it less. This person might sneeze and, you know, it puts on twice as much, or not know, oh, it's thin, it's not thick like mayonnaise, you know. So, you know, you start to look at all those different components, and it's like, wow, okay, 16 ounces per table for a table of 8, just to make sure. So, you know, so you have to account for that too. And guess what? Things happen in the kitchen. I've seen servers drop whole trays of dressing. Then what do you do?
Right.
I only ordered so much beer.
you know, let's talk about the beer components in today and tomorrow night's menu. So tell me about the beers that you're using and how you're pairing them up with the menu. And it's a good time to talk about the menu itself.
Yeah. So, you know, one, we're in Minnesota. You know, I wanted to make sure that, you know, I'm not in Minnesota very often, and I like to always learn as much as I can about the local area. I like to also understand more about, you know, the regional delights and why those are. And then how can we incorporate that with the flavors of beer into the final actual meal? So, you know, it's kind of neat to think about Minnesota, wild rice, you know, that's a very popular thing. So I thought that would be an easy starch right off the bat. You know, because of cost and because of what we're charging for the banquet, you know, I mean, to do this, the labor that it takes to do this, the hotel, to have all the infrastructure, you know, it takes a lot of background just to make this happen. So it's not all that just going towards the food. So with that, you know, and labor, you know, we have to think about, okay, chicken will work in this budget, maybe pork, maybe a few other things, you know, and trying to do it, you know, where it makes sense. And then also, we start to think about the beers that we have, you know, and each beer really starts to add its own flavor, its own component to, you know, when you stop and you think about, you know, your stout, your porter, your pale ale, your Hefeweizen, your wit, you know, your red ale, all these different beers have different flavor profiles. And each one of those, if you start to think about that beer and that flavor as an ingredient, and now you can actually add specific flavors. You like a rose component, you like a fruity component, you like a herbally component, you like a citrusy component. All those things you can now actually twist and actually adjust your recipe accordingly.
So how did you do that in this menu?
So this one, working with Rogue Ales, you know, with John and Stacy Meyer, I think it's just it's really fun because, you know, John gets back to his homebrew roots, and it's really neat to think about flavors with him and the beers that they actually have. And, you know, it's really generous because they actually donate all the beer for the whole dinner.
Wow.
So, I mean, when you start to look at how much beer that is, you know, I mean, I have 90 gallons to cook with.
Yeah.
I love my job. But to be able to stop and say, hey, so now we have, you know, their whole lineup of beers to go through. You know, and I start thinking about, okay, how can I pull the theme together with practicality and then what's going to be best to pair with as well. Mm-hmm. And so it starts to become kind of an interesting interchange of what about this to this to this, and start to like connect dots essentially and think about flavor profiles and what I can express or what I can, you know, suppress, or hey, I want to compare these flavors, I want to complement these, I want to contrast these and really, you know, make this stand alone for its own flavor profile.
Right.
And then you start thinking about texture, you start thinking about, you know, how is this all going to lay on the plate, and what, when you taste it, you know, it's like, going to be like, wow, that's a great bite.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Because when you start to think about, like, the entree, we have three different beers in just the food.
Mm-hmm.
And then we're pairing with a fourth beer. And so you really have to start thinking about how those flavors are going to work together. Are they going to be just a war of flavors in your mouth?
Right.
I mean, you start to look at, you know, when something doesn't work, it doesn't work for a reason.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, wait a minute, I don't know what was going on in my mouth. I mean, that's not fun.
Yeah.
So, and to think about, okay, like, you know, is this a flavor that's this nostalgic component of, you know, I mean, when you say ice cream, everybody lights up. There's an association of that creaminess on your palate. There's a sense of warmth, whether that comes from milk or formula as a kid. I mean, it's one of the first things that we had for 9 months. So how do you play up that? How do you use that, not necessarily in an ice cream setting, but in a different form as far as an entree or a dessert?
Mm-hmm.
And also, working with beer, we're doing something completely different because wine doesn't have bitterness. It has tannins,
right.
But it doesn't have bitterness.
Right.
And so how we braise it or how we sear it or how we reduce it, or, you know, if we use it as, you know, a vinaigrette, or if we're using it into something like a cake, I mean, it starts to really change because, you know, there's alcohol, there's all these other factors we've got to look at. And it's not just water. You know, and so understanding that and then thinking about, you know, if we can add in caramelized onions or, you know, some other sweet factors, you know, when we cook things longer, it actually intensifies the flavors. Like with the mirepoix, your carrots, your onions, your celery, your leeks, your, you know, if you put some thyme, some bay leaf, and you use that as a base,
yeah.
And you put your, you know, and that's your stock, and then you reduce that down after, you know, 2 hours or so, and you use that for your rice, you're getting a lot more flavor than just water.
Mm-hmm.
And then if the beer is also in there, like the hazelnut brown, with, you know, some fresh toasted hazelnuts and the mirepoix and all that with wild rice and some white rice mixed in for color and for depth of texture,
mm-hmm.
we're going to have a side dish that's, you know, a brown ale, caramelized vegetables, some herbs. We have the hazelnut brown ale, which has the toffee flavors, some hazelnut flavors, a little bit of toast, a little bit of roast.
Mm-hmm.
All those flavors with the rice, you got a great side dish.
Yeah, that's
and that's killer. Just the side dish. And then to think about it, that we need over 60 pounds of rice.
Yeah.
And then how do you cook 60 pounds of rice?
One big old cooker.
And that's the thing, like, you know, 45 gallons at a time.
Yeah.
So that's two batches of 45 gallons. So start thinking, like, when you homebrew, you don't do a 45-gallon. I mean, that would take you six batches to do, you know, thereabouts. And it's like, depending on your system, it's like you sit there and it's like, wait a minute here. You know, this is a whole other thing. So
what I think is so interesting that I'm hearing you talk about is that you have to start from, conceptually, you came up here and you said, I want to look at the culture of this place, the history of this place, the food culture, the food history of it. I'm going to bring
ancestry.
That component, the ancestry. I'm going to highlight some of that.
Yeah.
Then I'm going to look, and I'm going to look at the beers that I've got to work with. How can I bring those flavors in? I'm going to look at my budget.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, just can I afford it or not?
I mean, this is not a cheap dinner.
It's not a cheap dinner. And then balancing all of that, then just the scale of the dinner.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this isn't a dinner party for eight. It's a dinner party
for 900. I mean, think about how many servers we'll have. We'll probably have 60 servers just to bring the food out to you. That's more than most people's home brew club.
Yeah.
Just to bring food out to the table. That's not including to make the food. What think about washing the dishes. Think about how long it's going to take to wash almost 2,800 plates. And that's just plates. That's not the silverware. That's not the china. That's just plates. Mm. That will take somebody like 2 days. But they have a system downstairs where it's a conveyor belt for a dishwasher, and they can wash dishes as fast as they can put them in the machine on the other side, as fast as they're coming out.
Yeah.
But that's what's amazing. I mean, that's where it's a whole nother ballgame.
Right.
And that's also where, you know, to be able to do this, I mean, it's just a treat because, you know, the Sheraton, they open up their kitchen to me. It's not my kitchen. I mean, there's a whole nother variable in there is that I've never worked here before. I've been to Minnesota, but I haven't stayed here. I don't know the chefs. I don't know the staff. I don't know exactly where they get all their products from. So I have to work very closely with them, too, to help, you know, hey, so what do you think about this? And, I mean, I can come up with the most crazy menu, but if you can't pull it off or these guys don't have that piece of equipment that,
right.
Oh, okay, then how are we going to do that? You know, because there's a lot of different ways to cook something. You know, there's a lot of different ways to prepare something. But if you only have one oven, you shouldn't have all your dishes have a baking component to them.
Right.
I see it happen, and I'm like, why did you do that?
Yeah.
Jeez. But that's where you think about everything. And then also, when you actually show up, you know, I've already asked a lot of the questions, like, what kind of equipment do you have? How much space? How much walk-in space? How much, you know, how many sheet trays do you have? So when you start thinking about, you know, we'll use probably 400 sheet trays, like big, giant sheet trays. And it's like when you think about, you know, do you have 400 of those? And those are $18 a pop. That's a lot of inventory.
And did they have everything that you wanted?
Yeah, I mean, for the most part. And if not, we can adapt because they'd be flexible enough to actually be able to say, hey, wait a minute here. We can go from grilling to sautéing to just roasting the chicken breast, depending on what they had.
Yeah.
You know, we can crank the temperature of the oven up to 500 degrees versus 375. We can use the grill to mark them or cook them all the way through because they got a whole line of grills, you know. Or, hey, they have smokers. Hey, let's smoke the chicken. Let's do it that way. You know, we do a cold smoke or we do a hot smoke. And, you know, so that way you can actually, like, layer it with different flavors. Hey, an apple component would be really nice. Or a cherry, you know, that would be kind of fun too. You know, and then thinking about, hey, this fruit's in season right now, let's use this, you know. And so that's where, again, you can just add another layer, and it's this onion that at the end of the day, it all has to taste good.
Right, right. And, yeah, that's the other thing that I'm picking up is, that you're talking about is this layering effect of just building flavor component upon flavor component and being mindful that the last flavor component that you put on has to mesh well with the first flavor component you put on.
Exactly.
To me, that's where the art of this comes
in. It's art. I mean, and it's also, it's neat too, because in order to get to this level, you have to have the experience. You have to have the flavor depth and profile and understanding, you know, how many different beers you've tried and tasted and to know a whole product line. I mean, it's not like I get to have the opportunity to sit down and try every single beer before I get to cook with it.
Sure.
And so I have to ask the right questions about, you know, like last year's conference, there was two beers that weren't even available yet. And we had already, like, lined them up to be used and actually showcased as a first time, like, this is the release of this beer.
Mm-hmm.
Here you go. And to me, that's what's really fun is because, you know, we're all beer geeks, you know. There's a reason why we like to drink.
Yeah.
And so to be able to have some of these beers at the first time release, you know, I do a lot of dinners up at the Ebenezer, you know, and I worked with Jason Perkins and Rob Todd to get the first release of Vagabond. You know, we had the only keg in existence.
Hmm.
And when you start thinking about that beer and that those flavors, and I'm working a whole dish around it, so they actually FedExed me a couple bottles because it was such a complex beer. And, you know, that was it. There was, what, 300 bottles of that. Done.
When you start to put together a beer dinner, do you start with the beer, or do you start, like we were talking earlier, about the culture of the place? I mean, or is it just whatever mood you're in at that day?
It's hard. It's. I mean, to be honest, it's so many different factors. I could be walking down the street because I think about this stuff probably way too much. Well, there's a lot of jokes about, because I am a stay-at-home dad, and Finney Chillerzo from Russian River, he's always funny. He's a stay-at-home dad. You don't have to worry about it, you know. But it's fun because I do. I mean, I'll be playing with my daughter, or I'll be working on the computer, or I'll be in the kitchen, or I'll be drinking a beer at a bar and say, hey, wait a minute, this would be a great flavor profile. Or you hear something on the radio and you're like, huh, I guess peaches are in season, you know. Or you're walking through the farmer's market and you get this inspiration of like, hey, wow, green almonds, you know, I haven't seen those in a while, and it's, you know, they're only around for a two-week window every year, and, yeah. You know, look, I caught that particular night I was there, and boom, they were there, and I'm able to cook with them. And so, you know, it's interesting to kind of look at, you know, what does inspire us, you know, I mean, to make a beer.
Sure.
Like, what inspires you to make that beer, you know, that particular day, you know, or to put those spices or those hops or... Mm-hmm. You know, because are you just looking to completely recreate a beer you've already done or out of a book? Or you say, hey, wait a minute, that would be great because I love that as a kid, you know, peanut butter and jelly, you know, or whatever it was. And it's like, hey, can you make a beer like that? You know, I mean, at GBF, I keep getting that peanut butter beer. And I'm like, God, I want to put this in Thai food.
Yeah, no kidding.
But, I mean, that's where, again, you know, it's like you try something. You're like, wow, wait a minute. You know, almost every beer that I drink, I put it through like a thought process. Like, God, what would be good with this? What am I tasting? What is this, you know, do I like the textures of it? You know, the viscosity, is the alcohol too dominant, or this is way too cold? You know, let's let this warm up a little bit too, and really try to get those nuances out of the beer. And then, you know, it's like, okay, so would this be good with duck? Would this be good with fish? Would this be good with salmon? Would this be good with halibut or ono or opa or manchong? Or let's go into duck or wild boar or pheasant or, you know, Cornish game hens. You know, like really start thinking about, hey, so then from there you start to look at what your budget is, and then you start to look at like, huh, we can maybe make that work. And then, huh, what about this? And then you start to overlay maybe a beer, you know, like, okay, now this beer will really shine, or you know, let's switch that around, let's do something different. So it's kind of like back and forth, and then finally with each thing, you know, it's just like you start to look at this and there's 18 different recipes to make this one dinner.
It's astounding to me,
but that's what's so much fun. I mean, we do it every day, you know, whether you realize it or not, you make choices. And if you start to look at those choices and say, as a conscious choice versus just by coincidence, say, hey, you know, there's a reason why that recipe has that combination of hops at those particular, you know, additions, and then understanding that, and like you actually crafting that beer, you know, same thing with food.
Sure.
It's not different.
That's right.
It's you're using different tools, you're using different components, but that's also what's so neat to me is that you're able to really, you know, driver's seat, you have the steering wheel. Like, what direction do you want to go with it? Do you want to go sweet? Do you want to go malty? Do you want to go bitter? Do you want to go sour? Do you want to go fruity? You know, and then with that, you know, because if you start designing your own beers for dinners or events, why not?
Sure. Yeah. And I think that it's one of the really fun things about food and beer, and I'm going to talk about music for a minute. I'm a musician, and I'm a jazz musician. And that means that I spend a lot of time improvising.
Oh, totally.
Improvisation is what it's all about. But you have to understand the architecture underneath the improvisation.
The fundamentals.
And that's the parallel back to food and beer.
It's the same thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so and that's what makes it fun.
Yeah.
And then you can fly near the sun and hope your wings don't melt.
But also you can push it to a way and you know, this is where I struggle. I mean, if you think about cooking for 930, 40 people, right? There's no way everybody tastes the way I taste.
Mm-hmm.
There's things that I take for granted, you know, Kobe beef tongue. If I can ever get it, I'll get it as much as I possibly can. Yes, it's beef tongue, but it's a phenomenal piece of meat. There's one per animal. That's it. You don't see them around because the Japanese buy them at $20 a pound.
Yeah.
I mean, that's more than filet.
Yeah.
But you start to look at understanding that ingredient. Why is it so good? Well, it's like, understanding anything else and why we like something. And then if we could play with that and make it into something really unique, mm-hmm. and you have the foundations of how to cook it, and then you start to think about what you want it to taste like and almost reverse engineer it, say, mm-hmm. if I did this to this to this, okay, yeah, that's going to work. Or let's try this instead, and boom, that's going to work. And that's what's great when you're improvising, I'm sure. I mean, yep. I would love to be able to play music.
So would I.
Because there is something just amazing with, you know, how many different choices you have at that particular second and what direction you want to go.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you have somebody next to you who might change the tempo or something.
Exactly.
You know, it's like, okay, let's go here.
Well, hey, you know what? That's the thing. That's something I want to talk about in the kitchen. You know, so you are the chef. You are the executive chef of the meal.
Mm-hmm.
But that means you have a lot of you have a sous chef, you have a pastry chef, you have a salad chef, you have line cooks.
Oh, yeah.
You have all these folks that have to be able to work together as a team. and talk a little bit about the challenge of making that happen, and even the challenge of making that happen in an oppositional kitchen. Maybe somebody doesn't like what you're doing.
Or even it's not a kitchen where, I mean, I cook a lot of dinners where I don't even have a kitchen.
Oh, there you go.
You know, I mean, I cook a lot, too, where I don't even have people who have culinary degrees. I don't have a culinary degree. I didn't go to cooking school. I took a couple classes on a couple things I wanted to learn more on.
Yeah.
And I still do that. I still take classes from butchers. I mean, I like to learn about how to take apart a whole animal. Maybe I'm a geek. But, you know, if I start hunting, which, you know, I think that there's a lot to be said about that. You know, I mean, it's all how deep you want to get, you know.
Right.
On my culinary checklist was to actually help kill an animal and help butcher it, you know, and I was able to do that in January where we had two Brookshire pigs that were phenomenal animals, and I was able to pick them out of the whole herd, and we brought in a butcher with a mobile unit, and we ended their lives. I mean, we, mm-hmm. you know, and I watched the yin and yang of life and the life cycle, and to actually be able to see the meat, and, you know, it's not in a styrofoam package with cellophane right. on it.
Yeah.
I mean, I watched it die. And then to say, hey, wait a minute here. I want to make sure every single piece of that animal is used mm-hmm. and respected because it did give its life. And yeah. I want to not just eat it to eat it. I want to give it into a point where it's been respected, it's been transformed into something that it's not, it's so recognizable because I want that meat to show through, but then I also, I want it to be something that the guest or the eater will say, wow, this is a treat, mm-hmm. you know, and not just be like, yeah, it's another meal, we have to eat three meals a day, no big deal.
Right.
You know, because that's the other thing. Everybody eats, so yeah. everybody's a critic.
Yeah, everybody's
like everybody drinks, you know. Oh, this is a great beer. Oh, this beer sucks. I mean, it's funny to hear just, you know, in one room how people's palates are all different. And so to think about that, too, with a dinner for that many people and say everybody's flavor profile is different and what can you do to say, mm-hmm. okay, this is a great medium that's going to hit everybody. It's not too salty. It's not too sweet. It's not too spicy. It's not too bitter. You know, I mean, there's all these factors you have to think about people's palates and how can you push it. But
balance.
Then also you want it to have flavor, you know, it's not like cat food, you know, where every bite's the same.
Right.
Yeah. It's tuna flavor.
Put some cheese on that. So what is it like working in a kitchen with a whole lot of folks? I mean, you know, I'm used to cooking all by myself. I mean, I don't even, like, can I help you? No! I'm busy.
I've kicked my wife out of the kitchen a few times. My domain, back!
Back! So, but here you are, and so you're cooking with a chef you've never worked with, and you want to convey your concept of the food. Do you find that people are well enough trained, you might say, or they're professionals? And so when you talk, well, we're going to do this and this and this, we're going to do a mirepoix, we're going to do it, and that seems to be enough, or do you have to really do a lot of coaching, or particularly when you're cooking with beer?
It's really interesting because, I mean, you bring up great points. I mean, every single thing I have to think about. And on top of that, not just with this particular dinner, but every dinner I do. You know, I mean, I was just up at Seattle Beer Week at Brower's Cafe, you know, to do a special dinner with Firestone. And we do this dinner, and what's great about it is that I know it's Brower's. But then again, I haven't cooked there. I don't know the chef. I mean, we start talking on the phone, we start rapping about ideas, and then it's like, okay, cool. You know, we find that connection and boom. But
right.
you know, certain hotels, you know, it's like, you know, people don't really drink the beers that we do. Or, you know, when you're cooking at a volume, it's different. I mean, mm-hmm. it's hard to have passion when you got, you know, tomorrow night we're going to have 1,840 chicken breasts. that went through that whole brining process.
Mm-hmm.
That will take somebody 2 days
yeah.
of fussing and mussing with something. Mm-hmm. You're probably ready for it to be out the door.
Right. Well, you know, my big story that I was telling is when I was doing an internship in college, studying to be a chef, when I knew that I didn't want to be a professional chef was when I had to cook 400 chickens.
Yeah.
And I knew at that moment, this isn't what I want to do.
Yeah.
But I totally
you got
get
to that point.
I got to that point.
Yeah.
And that isn't to dismiss doing that. But I mean, I'm in awe of you and others that do this every day. Because I know what it takes to do that.
And nobody really realizes how much effort it takes to actually put that food onto the table.
And make sure that the first guy that gets his meal and the last guy that gets his yeah. meal get the same meal.
Or to make sure that, you know, hey, I can't eat this because of allergy or health concerns. And, you know, to be able to have that option. Or, you know, I'm a vegetarian. I would like something besides just a standard... you know, play to this or tofu that, you know, it's like, you know, mm-hmm. so to also take that same consideration for a vegetarian or thinking about, you know, each course because the first and last course are vegetarian friendly. So by naturally. So, mm-hmm. you know, and it's interesting too is because, you know, to work with so many different people in the kitchen and especially when it's people I haven't worked with before. So I really enjoy sharing the craft. I mean, that's why I'm doing this show with you guys and the stuff that I do out in the community is because, you know, I really want to make people better cook, but whether it's in the kitchen or in the brewery or, mm-hmm. you know, in their own life. I mean, this is enriching stuff that we take for granted. I mean, right. the fundamental change in our society in the last 100 years, I mean, we don't have to gather anything, you know, but hey, it's really cool to have a garden in your backyard and get back to your roots, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, I have raspberries in my backyard, and I pick them with my daughter every day. And she gets a half a cup of raspberries that she's like, I mean, these are perfect, you know.
Yeah.
And it's great to see her just, like, hound them in, you know, 3 minutes, and she's had this amazing little snack. But yeah. then, you know, you look at, you know, some people grow their own hops. You know, it's the same thing with the harvest, you know. I mean, I've been toying around with the idea about growing my own barley. I mean, if Sierra Nevada can do it, I can do it. I mean, I've malted my own buckwheat before because I wanted to do a buckwheat ale. And I'm like, hey, how hard would it be to actually malt buckwheat? Funky process. Mucus and slime at a whole nother level.
Well, I think alfalfa and darler were easier to malt than buckwheat.
But let me tell you, the ale that came out of it was phenomenal. And actually, I'm craving to brew it again because it was so unique and flavorful. And actually, I want to use that same process to malt the buckwheat, to actually do a buckwheat saison. You know, and it would be just a really just great flavor, and I think it'd just be great with food.
Yeah.
So, and again, it's just like that, oh, wait, this would be a fun combination, and this was kind of a neat idea.
Yeah. That's how I cook. I mean, you know, when I'm at the house and doing a party for somebody, and I go to the market, and I do that every day almost. We don't buy, like, groceries for the week or for 2 weeks. We have a few staples, and practically every day I run by somebody's market and what's fresh today, and then that's the, you know, how the meal gets planned.
And so, that's how it was for the longest time. I
yeah.
mean, really stop and think about, like, you know, okay, this is in season, this is ready, this isn't ready. I mean, you know, whoop, guess what? We did catch dinner tonight. Plan B.
Hey, I want to ask you how long, I'm kind of changing the subject, but I want to ask you how long you've been working on this dinner. When did you start?
So, good question, because basically I was sitting at the table with Charlie and Gary Glass and the whole HABA team, and John Meyer and Stacey Meyer were there with Sebi, and they're like, okay, Sean, are you doing this next year? And
so that was a year ago.
Yeah, so I've had a year to kind of think about this, and, you know, right when they said the next city, which, you know, was good old Minnesota, so,
right.
you know, it's like, Minneapolis, I thought, was like, okay, you know, right away I started thinking about, you know, okay, I've been there once before, and I know what they do, and, you know, I've tasted food from there, so I understand, you know, but also I want to get a little bit more into the ancestry, you know, I mean, I'm a quarter Norwegian, and I have some other little parts here and there, and so that Scandinavian descent, yeah. you know, and...
I noticed there's no lutefisk on the menu.
Well, you know, and that's what's interesting. I mean, I did look at that. I did look at cheese curds. I mean, to really start, you know... To have a year to think about something, okay,
yeah.
it's a trip, you know, and it's a trip to be that busy where I have a year to plan something. You know, and that's also another trip. But, you know, to be able to sit there and say, okay, how can I change or transform these ingredients to have this flavor? Because, I mean, really stop and think about food. Okay, every cuisine has onions. Every yep. cuisine has carrots. Every cuisine has celery. Guess what? Every beer has barley, one form or another, or sorghum.
Yeah.
You know, but, you know, you start to look at, okay, so that's a standard. Okay. Out of that, we have 91 different styles just judged at, you know, the World Beer Cup. Okay. It's not just pale ales and porters and stouts and ambers. I mean, mm-hmm. there's a lot of great beers out there. And you start to look at some of these different styles that are forgotten, and us as home brewers can keep those styles alive and actually maybe help to actually show breweries, like, hey, wait a minute, you should be brewing this because I want to drink it.
Yeah, for sure.
I mean, Berliner Weiss, please.
Yeah.
Bring back the Berliner Weiss. It's a perfect lawnmower beer. It's a perfect food beer. It's a great, you can express so many different things with that sourness. Mm-hmm. Fruit to savory to sweet. I mean, it's just really unique. I mean, think about Woodruff and the whole concept of Woodruff. Mm-hmm. You know, so many different angles you could take that.
The American beer palate, this is an exciting time to be around beer.
Huge.
Really exciting. I mean, I can remember, James can remember, you can remember when you go to the liquor store, the package store, and it was like Killian's Red was exciting.
Yeah.
You know?
Or, and then a few of the beers you were really excited to try because you never seen it before and you were hoping you'd never see it again.
Yeah, exactly, for sure. But now, well, it's just a wonderful time. And I believe that the home brewing movement has a lot to do with it, that we're really
huge.
Driving that.
We have changed how commercial breweries look at beers.
Yeah.
Because we buy those beers. Uh-huh. We have created a market. We have shown by our dollars that we are willing to stand in line. I mean, look at Dark Lord Day. I mean, come on. I mean, I was at Pliny the Younger release for San Francisco Beer Week when they sold almost 30 barrels of Pliny the Younger in growlers and in glasses that were half pints in less than 8 hours.
Wow.
They had 1,000 growlers that they had brought in and filled, mm-hmm. and all those went like were gone, and everybody replaced theirs. And Vinny and Natalie stood there with two taps each, filling growlers as fast as they could all day long. Mm. It was insane. I felt so bad for them, but yet they worked their ass off and they made it happen, and that beer was gone in a day.
That's amazing. Well, you know, along with homebrewers changing the beer environment, I think folks like you are changing the food environment.
I try.
You are trying. And you're doing it. We had an experience. We hosted a beer tasting for some local chefs and people in Fayetteville, and I went back to the restaurant where one of the chefs had come from. And lo and behold, there were some breads that had the beers in them. There was a couple of sauces that had some ales in them. It was directly because of the food tasting. So we changed that restaurant's menu.
Yeah.
And you're doing that on a much grander scale than we are. So
But stop for a minute, because it's every little bit everybody doing, because if you support it, think about the value of your dollar, okay?
Right.
You worked very hard to get that dollar. So when you spend it at a certain location, a certain restaurant, you're supporting them whether you realize it or not.
Sure.
And you're also supporting what you're eating. You're supporting where that money goes. If you like foie gras, God damn it, buy it. If you don't buy it.
Right.
But don't let me make that choice if I want to have it or not and deal with the implications of what I'm choosing to eat.
Right.
I don't, you know, say no to anybody. If you're vegan, if you're vegetarian, if you're a pescatarian, if you're just all about is bacon, we can make that happen, okay? And I understand each one. And I'm not saying that there's one better or another.
Right.
But if we choose as a society and say, hey, my dollar goes here and it supports this.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, think about what happens. Like when you go to the farmer's market, there's something to be said. You are giving that farmer, the one who made that food, mm-hmm. your money. There is no middleman. He is not getting half or a third of that.
Right.
When you really stop to think about the grocery store, they make a lot of money. They pay for your parking spot as you're in that.
Sure.
The farmer shouldn't have to pay for that.
Right.
And he's there showing his wares to you. And actually, that's the perfect environment to sit down with him and actually say, how do you prepare this? What do you recommend
right.
with this? You grow, you know, 1,800 pounds of this every year.
Right.
You know, I mean, there's an interesting perspective there. And you actually get back to the sense of community. You start to actually slow down a little bit because, you know, when we make beers, right, we spend all this time researching the historical aspects, understanding mm-hmm. the ingredients. We think about, you know, the season that that beer was made because of its refreshing qualities, or like a saison, and like, you know, just because of that particular time period, it was safer to drink water, and hey, what a great way to incorporate what we're already growing. So you start to look at these things, same thing with food, and then like how in which we choose to support that or keep that going or have that Sunday dinner, you know, right. Turn off the TV and communicate. I mean, how great is it with the homebrew community that we're able to hang out for, you know, what, 4 hours last night at Pro Brewers Night and have great beers and have great conversations around beers, mm-hmm. and just hang out with one another. I mean, it's community, right? I mean, Tonight we got club night. I can't wait to see what people are dressed as.
Oh, and, no.
You know, I mean, it's unreal when you walk in there and it's like, I never thought about doing that before, and God, does that ever work? Thank you for trying that. You know, that's really awesome. I mean, it kind of blows your mind in a whole other way, and it's just like, that's a great, you know, place for inspiration.
Yeah, absolutely. That's what I'm looking forward to tonight with Club Night. It's the inspiration to go back home and say, wow, I tried this coconut lime beer that was just killer.
Yeah.
Get out the shrimp. Let's go.
And that's the thing. And that's where if you just stop for a minute and slow down and say, hey, wait a minute. You know I have a microwave. I know I have a coffee machine that turned on before I do. I know I have a bread machine that can make bread. All these different things. But, like, why?
Yeah.
Why? I mean, it's a simple question. It's a one-word question. But then, you know, my three-year-old, you know, she asks it all the time to me. Why?
Why, Dad?
But when you stop and you think about what we have and our choices that we make, and how we do things, and if we're going to choose to make the beer we like to drink, or we're going to choose to make the food we like to eat, and then we start to, you know, pull the two together, and it's a whole nother level in that, you know, wine doesn't have bitterness. It doesn't have the complexity as far as, it's not just red and white, mm-hmm. you know, or rosé. I mm-hmm. mean, we have a lot of opportunities with these flavors, and if you treat each beer as a flavor, as an ingredient, and what that will add to chicken, what that will add to duck, what that will add to rice, what that will add to vegetables, your tomato sauce, your pasta sauce, your ice cream, I mean, it's endless.
Sure. That's great.
You know?
Well, listen, I want to thank you for your time today.
Oh, you're very welcome, Steve.
I'm so looking forward to this meal tomorrow night.
Should be fun.
I think it'll be great. Next time we get together, I have two words I want to talk about with you. Duck fat.
Oh. Okay, go.
Thank you, Sean.
Thank you, guys.
It was fun being a fly on the wall listening to that conversation. I'm lucky to be able to hang out with talented folks like Steve and Sean and taste their food and beer every now and then. Can't wait until next year at the National Homebrewers Conference in San Diego. Make your plans now. Get with your boss. Get those dates set aside. If you have brewing questions, show suggestions, or just want to say howdy, write to james@basicbrewing.com or just fill out the contact form on basicbrewing.com. Please don't forget to tell us where you're from. You can check out our homebrewing DVDs, Introduction to Extract Homebrewing, Stepping into All Grain, Low-Tech Lagering and Decoction Mashing, and Introduction to Wine Kits. Got combo deals to save you a few bucks if you want to buy more than one DVD at a time, and you can check out our Basic Brewing shirts in the store too. You can see a listing of the fine folks across the country who sell our DVDs on basicbrewing.com, and if there isn't a vendor in your area, you can order them online in our online shop at basicbrewingshop.com, and I'll pack them up and send them to you my own self. Thanks to everybody who's continued to click on our amazon.com link. We appreciate the support there. Our featured products this week that were purchased through the link are 100 8-inch premium glow stick bracelets, 10-color mixed assortment, and Wahl Professional 8655-200 peanut clipper trimmer, black. Thanks again, everybody. And remember, I can't tell who bought what, so no worries there. Just click on the Amazon.com logo on our site the next time you feel like Amazon shopping, and we appreciate your support. And don't forget that you can also join the American Homebrewers Association and subscribe to Brew Your Own magazine through the associate links on our site, too. That's all until next time. Until then, thanks for listening, everybody. I'm James Spencer. Production help for Basic Brewing Radio and our website is provided by Kelly Dodson. Basic Brewing Radio is a production of Active Voicing. We'll talk to you next time, everybody. So long.